Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to The Hobcast Book Show, show number 77 in this epic run of podcasts that we have created so far.
77, the year that Virginia Wade won Wimbledon.
It is, yeah, and the Queen attended. She hardly ever goes
and
to Wimbledon.
And it was her Jubilee, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was, Silver Jubilee.
I remember it well.
Yeah, now we've had a Platinum one. Well, welcome to the show. My name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Crime.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
And thrillers.
I was being the Grand Prix.
Yeah, I'm not sure which era of Grand Prix engine you were. Perhaps you were the V10 engine, which is the one everyone prefers.
How did you guess?
Well done.
You Blimey, know. You're good.
They used to say of Murray Walker that Murray Walker's excited voice was exactly the same timbre and pitch.
It was.
As a V10 engine. Hey, look at that! You know, that kind of thing.
I think that happens to him, poor bloke.
Bless him. He passed away last year at 97 years old. Lovely man. Had the pleasure to spend some time with him over the years. So, we've digressed already. That's the nature of this show.
When you say we.
Well, you brought it up. And I just followed the thread. That's what we do.
Oh, it's all my fault then.
Okay, well, let me just bring things to order and tell you who is on the show this week. Mary Kendall is joining us from the United States.
Away.
Yeah, from the United States. And Mary Kendall is a writer of historical fiction and reached out to us when we were having one of our temporary trawls for emergency guests, which happens every so often. We've fairly full books at the moment. In fact, people are sort of approaching us and saying, how do we come on the podcast?
Do you know what? I like having emergency guests, though, because...
Yeah, it's brilliant because it puts us on our mettle a little. But, you know, even last week when we were in Southwold, and if you haven't caught it, the Slaughter in Southwold episode is one of my favourites to date. You know, it's seat of the pants podcast making because, to be honest, neither William Shaw nor Cara Hunter knew that we were going to approach them for a podcast.
They had absolutely no idea.
But they were brilliant and they really entered the spirit of what we try to achieve. So that was a terrific episode. And, you know, Mary did the same. So we'll look forward to speaking to Mary Kendall a little bit later in the programme. There's some news to get through and we've got tons of Hoback developments to take you through as well. it's going to be really big. I've got a very busy week coming up. I'm sorry, you're home alone with the kids this week and I'm in London, you know, getting drunk and doing publishing things.
Yes. So
we'll talk about that later. You know, just dab your eyes a bit more. Let's get into some news. Well, in terms of crime writing, the shortlist for the Theakston's award came up, which is, of course, the feature event. Thank you very much.
Finding you dropped his phone.
I dropped my phone. That's terrible. I blame Mackie. She's asleep.
Look, she's about a foot away from us at the moment.
She
curled
is.
Up in a ball. You can see a body, two paws and an ear at the moment.
Pretty standard behaviour for her. So at Harrogate Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival at the Old Swan Hotel, there will be the awards night. And the six books that are up for that award are The Nighthawks by Ellie Griffiths, published by Quercus. True Crime Story by Joseph Knox, which, if I'm not mistaken, is in my
to-be.
Yeah, it's in my...
It was there.
It's in my to-be-read pile.
Yeah, I want to read that too.
On the mantelpiece there. Daughters of Night by Laura Shepherd Robinson.
Don't
published
know that
by
one.
Mantle Pan. Slough House by Mick Herron. Published by Baskerville. Yeah. Well, this time we're going to get an interview with him, I promise. Midnight at Malabar House by Vazim Khan. With Hodder and Stoughton, and The Last Thing to Burn by Will Dean also.
Oh, that is definitely on my to read pile. Because I've heard so many good things about that book. I really
And he's a really nice
fella.
He
is lovely.
And
isn't
we approached Vazim at Bristol. I just haven't got round to emailing him asking for an interview. So it may be that we need that interview if he's won the prize in Harrogate. And it, you know, on Harrogate things, Orion Publishing are going to have their incident room in the library at Old Swan, like they did last year, which is where they have special events for their authors.
Yeah.
But they've invited two podcasts to do some specials with them.
Incident. But not the Hobcast podcast.
So Blood Brothers are going to be there, and Crime Time FM are going to be doing podcasts. But they didn't invite us.
I have to say, actually, interjecting a little bit, but I saw... Don't hump at me. I saw a new... There's a new podcast which
I'm not
really,
humping at them, not you.
Oh. There's a new podcast that appeals to me because it's called Crime and Wine.
Ooh.
Now, I don't know anything about them yet. They've just appeared on Twitter and we follow each other. But, you know, I want to get to know them.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll do a double...
Because they combine crime with wine.
Well, why don't we do a double header? And I will get my... an old school friend of mine is one of the best independent wine merchants in the world.
He is. We've dabbled a bit.
Yeah,
with this wine.
He's won the International Wine Challenge Retailer of the Year. You know, like the wine merchant of the year umpteen times. And he's got a tiny... Well, it's not so tiny now. It used to be a tiny shop on the edge of Cambridge. But we used to have a locker. This is Noel Young Wines, if you care to look them up. But I guarantee if you buy a wine from them, you will not be disappointed. It's brilliant. No matter what the price point, it's amazing.
And what I like is, it's twice now, I think, isn't it? We've had a box of wines.
Yeah.
And there's a theme to the box. What was the last one?
Malbec. Argentine Malbecs.
And it's not just that they're not really expensive wines. They're moderately priced that we can afford them. So and they're really good.
Yeah.
And you get a sheet of white tasting notes.
Yeah, brilliant tasting notes. I mean, he's just basically, I don't know how genetically he was wired to discover great wines, but he does know his stuff. Anyway, that's Noel Young Wines. Not a sponsor of our program, but perhaps Noel, you might like to consider it at some point in the future, especially if there's a new podcast which deals with crime and wine. Anyway, so that's the Theakston's shortlist. And later in the week, it's the big one for us because Mark Whiteman's Waking the Tiger is in line. It's shortlisted for the John Creasy New Blood Award at the CWA Daggers, which is being held at the Leonardo Hotel and Tower Bridge in London, and I shall be attending. It's black tie do, but I've already heard from Mark's agent that he's not going to turn up in black tie,
no,
nor is indeed
I think
Mark.
Mark is dithering at
he's
the moment.
He's dithering about it. Okay, well, I've gone to the trouble because I went to dig out my DJ, and yeah, that's fine. It fits. A bit long in the sleeves, but that was always the case. I just haven't bothered to get it altered yet. But the trousers were 4 inches too big at the waist.
That's my fault.
Yeah, it is your fault. You better explain why it's your fault.
Two reasons. One, you have to eat my cooking. Two, I force you to play tennis 3 times a week.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You really force me to do that. And no, I love it. It's been brilliant. So, yes, I've lost a bit of weight, which is fantastic. But 4 inches, I mean, okay, it was extravagantly large trousers last time, but that's a significant weight loss.
He's disappearing.
Yeah.
So, before my eyes.
Well, that it feels good. It feels good. There's a long way to go yet.
But we are so, well, when I say, I am quite excited on your behalf, but I had a wobble.
That.
I had a wobble on Friday.
Did.
I was
you
actually
really
in
did.
Tears. And I said, okay, I went up to you and I said, it's not fair. I really want to go. And you go for two parties and I don't go to any parties.
Yeah.
I had a big wobble.
Because the one on Tuesday is the self-publishing show party. It's part of their self-publishing live event.
Now, the reason I had a wobble is because we were there for that, 3 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And we wimped out of going to the party because we were tired.
We were knackered. But you see, the thing was, it was going to be on a boat, one of those, you know, wining and dining boats that go up and down the Thames. So you had to be there. And once you were on it, you were stuck there. And apparently it was extremely hot on board. And a lot of people really struggled through it because, you know, there was no escape.
Oh, is it not on the boat this time?
No, it's not. It's actually simply in the lobby of where they're holding the overall event at 7 p.m. So
that's South Bank.
The South Bank, yeah. So that's going to be a lot.
So you can sneak off if you get too hot and tired.
Basically, yeah. So I'll be attending the second day of that conference and see what revelations there are. Broadly speaking, I'm not that optimistic, but our good friend Rachel McLean's going to be speaking, so it'd be good to see her too. But I'm sure there are a lot of familiar faces from the indie scene that I'll bump into at those two events, and then obviously the Daggers follows that. So
yes, And you've got quite a good menu, haven't you, for the night? And I would have eaten all of the things on the menu.
Yeah, but then, well, there's two menus. There's two menus. There's menu A and B. And I think A is like chicken something and a...
Chicken supreme. Tarragon sauce.
Right. and a mandarin cheesecake. I can't remember what the starter was.
Beetroot something.
Yeah, that's right.
It looked amazing.
Beetroot salmon.
I love that. I would love that.
No, okay, fine. Look, this is, and this is a first world problem, but the menu B was like a jackfruit steak. And, you know, vegan stuff. And so I'd put on my form for what I wanted, you know, do I have any allergies? And yes, I've got a slight gluten, well, quite considerable gluten intolerance. But they were going to force me onto meal B because of that.
And you didn't want to be?
Absolutely not. I'd rather have the consequences of eating gluten than eating jackfruit.
Yes, he would. He does it quite often. He would rather live with the consequences. At 3 o'clock in the morning.
Absolutely, absolutely. Listen, we've digressed already. We've already talked about, well, this is really what the stuff we usually do after the interview. So let's not burn...
We've got plenty more to talk about.
Yeah, let's not burn things through things too much. Let's get into some more news. Well, it's not so much news. It's a feature in this week's bookseller, which is a celebration of Northern Publishing. Well, I mean, it's almost patronising when they say, oh, look, Northern Publishing.
Well, you say that, but this was a bookseller Northern special.
Oh, yeah.
And they do this. They do a Welsh one every
Believe
now and
it
then.
Or not, they publish books in the North.
Yeah. Well, we should be pleased about this, though. Because
but we're not in the North.
No, I know we're not in the North, but there's hope if they look at the North, they will then turn on the way home to the Midlands.
Yeah, right. We're still a wasteland. But yeah, okay. So, I mean, this article, I mean, it's puffing things up a little bit. Hachette moved some of their operations to Sheffield, I think it was last year, and they're taking on some more people. So expanding their operation in the North. That's one reason why they're saying the North is rising in publishing. They're also, I mean, this is an interesting development because we discovered this week that our alma mater at Exeter University are launching an MA in publishing. And that came as a surprise to us. And so we wrote to their course leader and haven't heard back.
Not yet.
No. Disappointing.
Stop it.
Okay, they're probably on holiday right now. But anyway, but MAs in publishing are popping up everywhere. Northumbria University. In fact, I was only there yesterday with my son James, who's thinking of studying geography there. Really impressed with Northumbria. It's based in the centre of Newcastle, right next to Newcastle University, the more illustrious of the two traditionally. But really impressed with the facilities and the welcome and the standard of research and teaching, particularly in geography, was really high. I thought the way they handled the open day was fantastic. And so if they
did you get a T-shirt?
No, they didn't do the Manchester thing.
Ha-ha, Manchester gave me a T-shirt.
I got a tote bag.
Oh, well, a T-shirt's better than a tote bag.
Oh, okay. Got lots of freebies otherwise. I even got an energy ball to
What's
eat.
What's an energy ball?
Well, they have an outfit on campus who basically provide the catering for all the outlets. That's one thing they do. But what was really interesting, we went up to their stand to find out what these balls were. And they then told us that they actually run courses for the students to learn to cook.
That's good.
Yeah.
That is good.
That's really good. And they go in and sort of take a group of six people in their kitchen, their joint kitchen, and teach them some simple meals so they can do for each other, you know, economically and develop their skills. So there were lots of little bits of innovation about that place, Northumbria University, I thought was really impressive. And it's the sort of place where they don't accept that they're second place to their bigger rivals in the city. They're really going for it. And it was really imaginative the whole way it was set up. And the buildings are amazing, some of them, some of the new ones.
I think that cooking thing is really good, though, because I'm sure you came across fellow students who had absolutely no idea how to cook.
No, I used to cook for them because I was afraid that, you know, they were going to waste away after in your second year and third years.
Well, one of my housemates tried to grill a cucumber on toast.
Good Lord. Well, I had a housemate, Gavin, who used to, because he wouldn't wash up, we complained on him so much that he bought some cardboard plates and plastic cutlery.
I love that.
And therefore, he could just dispose of it. But he'd still use it three times. It could be Scottish. He used to use it, you know, these plates three times and cutlery, and then he'd chuck them away. Honestly, you know, it wouldn't do in today's society of trying to reduce plastic use. But it was quite imaginative and funny.
It was very funny.
Anyway, so there's MAs in publishing at Northumbria. at Exeter, and there's one also at Manchester Metropolitan, which I've been to things there. It's you know, basically on the Mancunian Way, the main buildings for the arts side of the institution. And again, much like you know, Northumbria, again, it's one of these former polytechnics which has really taken off and is giving Manchester University a much, much more established establishment, if that's not such a silly phrase, a real run for its money. But what's interesting to me is that there's so many courses and MAs in publishing. I don't know where the demand for people with MAs in publishing is coming from.
Well, I mean, Oxford Brookes, I think, were the pioneers in this, weren't they? They are well known for their MA in publishing. And then, of course, UEA as well. They got the sort of writing, more writing-focused. Yeah. But I think it's a really good thing. I mean, I think if I graduated now, I always wanted to work in publishing. I think I would have considered an MA in publishing.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know what things they're covering in these MAs in publishing. Because it's an industry which is still torn between traditional and independent ways of thinking and different formats. I mean, you know, there are still parts of the traditional publishing industry who still look down on ebooks without question. That, you know, it's not a real book if it's just an ebook. But that's changing, but slowly.
Well, I mean, the way to find out is to look at the course.
I guess so. And, you know, for anyone listening from one of those courses, we're very happy to come and talk.
Yeah, come on our podcast. If you're doing an MA in publishing, we'd love to talk to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any more news?
Only little titty bits, really.
I'll leave that one hanging.
I mean, you know, we've had books on long lists and short lists of prizes, and every time that happens, we sit there and go, oh, this is the magic moment. We're going to have to reprint thousands of copies. And it hasn't quite happened like that yet.
No.
But so the International Booker Prize was announced last week, which is quite a big prize, but it's not quite so publicised as much as the Booker Prize. So the publisher of the International Booker Prize is, they're called Tilted Axis, and I've heard of them. I quite like that, Tilted Axis.
That's nice, yeah.
They had to reprint, so they're the publishers of the winner. They had to reprint 15,000 copies and because sales had leapt. You'll never guess the percentage. 877% Blimey. Increase in sales.
So now, 15,000 print runs.
Mark, if you win on Wednesday.
Yeah, but he has another opportunity to win, because what we've forgotten to mention is that Waking the Tiger by Mark Whiteman has a fourth nomination now for a major award. Now, I can't remember how to pronounce this, so you better do it.
Well, I can write it. It's Nagio Marsh.
Award. Now, this is for Australasian...
New Zealand. They're based in New Zealand.
Okay.
They're a lovely organisation. You know, mm-hmm. I've had email exchanges with Craig, who sort of is the person in charge quite a few times now. And they just like to champion anyone with a connection with New Zealand or New Zealand citizenship, I think it is. And Mark does officially have citizenship with New Zealand. He's an international guy.
He is, basically. International man of mystery.
And so we were able to put him up for this award because of his connection with New Zealand.
Yeah.
And he's on the long list.
It's on the long list. And actually, interesting that they've made a big thing of, you know, the Singapore in the 1930s in their publicity as well. So it's had a really good push.
Yes.
Frankly.
And there's some really good books on that list, actually. I've been looking at them.
Well, I mean, so is his, but...
No, I know, but you know what I mean. It's
we're rather
a good,
close
solid
to
list.
Yeah, absolutely. No. I mean, it's great. So a fourth big award nomination. So congratulations to Mark. Well, let's hope, you know, that it goes the full way at the Daggers. If not, I'll just get drunk.
And I will at home. I've got some champagne.
next week, we'll, of course, feature quite a bit of the stuff that I'll gather in London from that event. You're off on holiday the week after, aren't you?
I am, yes. So a week today, I will be on my way to Anglesey with my mother, my brother and my sister. So it's like we're stepping back 35 odd years and having a family holiday.
That's weird. Well, I hope it goes well. We'll talk about that. You know, we'll have to link up somehow.
We will link up. We'll do something.
Essentially, though, this next coming week will be sort of my sort of travelogue around the London literary scene. And then you and I talking from distant Wales.
I'll be doing all the grind at home.
Oh, God. Well, who's doing it the week after? Moi.
Brilliant.
Yeah, okay.
Can't wait.
Authors, if you're listening, you will get replies eventually. You won't just get my out of office.
I think I'll probably get an email saying, I've tried to email Adrian about such and such, and just checking, is he around?
Yeah, notionally. Yeah, so that's good news for them. We're talking about the increase that an award win can make. Okay, let's get into our interview with Mary Kendall. And we really want to speak to as many authors around the world as possible. It's just, this is an international show.
Absolutely.
And Mary, it's a lovely story. She's a historian by trade and has great anecdotes about haunted houses. Her dad used to do up houses and things in the Washington area. And her book is based in the Washington area. The Spinster's Fortune is the title.
And she has a connection with Wolverhampton, which we talk about.
We do, we do. Anyway, let's hear from her. This is Mary Kendall. Well, it's a thrill and a delight to have Mary Kendall on the Hobcast Book Show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Adrian and Rebecca. I'm delighted to be here. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Well, it's our pleasure. And we would like to, first of all, thank you for your forbearance, because what people don't realise is just how many attempts we've made to get this going. And due to technical issues, it's been difficult. But we've got you now. And where are we speaking to you from?
So I live in the mid-Atlantic area of the United States, and specifically right outside of Baltimore, Maryland, otherwise known as the Charm City. Mm-hmm. You may have heard of it. Yep. And not too far from DC, which is actually the city I was born in. So not too far from where I started.
I love Washington.
Yes. Yeah.
I've been there once. I fell in love.
Oh, great.
Best bookshops great. Ever.
Yeah. They do have some good ones.
So, let's get straight to the quick, really, with your author career to date. So we know there's another book coming, but so far we are talking about The Spinster's Fortune.
Yes.
And take our audience through the genesis of that and what it's about.
Okay, so it is actually set in DC, which, as I said, is the city of my birth. And so it resulted from sort of my background as a historian. I trained up as a historian and have always retained an interest in research. That's kind of my wheelhouse. So I was researching some genealogy, which I have done for years. And recently in the genealogy world, everything has started to become populated on the internet, which is great. Yes. So I was drilling down in some historic newspapers to find some information out about my grandfather, who passed long before I was born. I really didn't know that much about him, except that he was a lawyer in DC, working in DC. And I was on the hunt for stories about him, and he worked on some famous cases, and up pops a photograph, which of course was delightful. But then I read the story that came with that photograph, which was the real life story that I based The Spinster's Fortune on. And the story was about a elderly woman who was in the poorhouse and of diminished mental capacity. And what was happening was that her abandoned house in Georgetown, which is a neighborhood in DC, her abandoned house was being ransacked and looted. And people were coming out with money and treasures. And so this was uncovered. And so the newspaper, I just started to go down the rabbit hole with the newspaper coverage of it. It became a big deal. There was national coverage of this that spanned over a 6-month period. So my grandfather was the lawyer on the case to help recover these monies. So that became the basis of the story. And then I just, I wanted to know why. How did this happen? How does something like this happen? So it was in exploring the why of it that I let my imagination spin out the rest. And that's how the story resulted.
That's fascinating. I love that, though, that a real life event sparked the story. So is the story sort of a fictional version of what happened, or is it?
Yeah, where does your imagination take it beyond what you could research?
So I used the framework of the real life story and a lot of the facts, but I have two main protagonists in the story. I have Blanche Magruder, which was her real name as the elderly spinster, and then using my imagination, I created a character named Margaret, who was her niece, who did not know her aunt well, but was they tapped into Margaret as the next of kin. And she became the exec in the fictional account, she became the executor. And then I used Margaret to sort of carry the story out and to figure out, how did this happen? How did her aunt get in these straits? Why was this not known? And so really the rest of the story about the money being uncovered and everything is fictional.
And that period, I mean, you're a historian. So how well did you know it in terms of, I mean, because one of the key things with historical fiction is getting that detail right and Absolutely. Getting the right balance of dropping in not everything you know, but mm-hmm. enough to mm-hmm. transport your reader to that period. So yes. how strong was that? That we're talking, you say 1929?
1929, yeah. So the 1920s era.
So we're talking what, Wall Street crash era, that kind of period?
But a bit before that is that right. when the story actually takes place. So that's actually my favorite, just ironically, that's when the actual event happened, but that's also my favorite period of history. I really? Love so much. Yeah. I love so much about that time period, just the aesthetic of it, the fashions, the history that was going on, the current events. So I was really drawn to that anyway. And so I guess, you know, part of me knew about that era to start with, but then I did drill down because, as you mentioned, we know historical fiction readers are very picky about getting the details straight.
Yes.
And, you know, I I'm a historical fiction reader myself. So I know if a detail is off, that'll throw the reader off the story right away. Sure. So there were a number of details that I really had to drill down and make sure were correct. Including this is kind of a side note, but as I was, you know, the endless edits that you go through and trying to get everything right, I had a cab in the story. A cab picks up Blanche at one point.
Yeah.
And I had it as a black and white cab. I had it as a yellow cab because they were in place by that time period. Okay. I don't know what made me think of it, but I decided to say, wait a minute, were they here? They actually did not come to DC until the next year. Ah. So I changed it to the cabs they did have that year, which were black and white cabs.
Black and white cabs.
And that's
yeah.
the sort of thing somebody would notice, isn't it? That
just,
sort of,
just
a year
in case,
out.
Just in case I would get that in a review, you know. But yeah, it's those kind of things. But that's actually fun for me. I like digging around and looking at the specific historic details. Of a
yeah.
situation. So that was fun.
So do you think it came naturally to you as a historian to want to write stories, to sort of go into this semi-fictional world?
Definitely. I think that from a young age, my imagination was sparked by history, and especially American history. And it probably sounds funny to you guys because we have a very young history
a bit more,
here.
Yeah.
So yeah, so yours is a bit different, but I grew up, my father was a history buff and his sort of hobby was renovating historic houses. So from a young age, I grew up in old houses and there are a lot of, things that in doing that could spark imagination. I mean, artifacts that were found underneath floorboards, and then even things that went bump in the night.
I
throw
have
that
to
out there
about that because I saw on your website that it said you grew up in old houses, and you know you had the experience
ghosts.
As a
yeah.
ghost. So
yes,
I'm
I had experiences.
Have
I
you
had
ever
experience.
Seen a ghost?
It's not so much as seeing as experiencing it with the other senses, I would say.
Yes.
You know, there were things that went on for, I'll throw a benign one out there.
Okay.
Being woken in the middle of the night and smelling the scent of lavender in the room, in one specific room of the house. So those kind of things. Mm. And as time went on, and now that I'm the age I am, I really feel strongly that when life happens and there's so much emotion and events that can go on in a place, I feel that it doesn't not make sense that that might be left behind. Something of that might be left behind in some way.
I absolutely agree. I mean, my sister lives in quite an old house, and me and my mum, independently of each other, we didn't realise we both felt the same way, but we don't like going in one particular room. Mm-hmm. And we once had a conversation later on, and I said, oh, you don't like it either. And she said, oh, I didn't know you didn't like going in there. Yeah. We both get the creeps. We don't know what it is, but we both get the creeps.
Which room is it?
Well, I think it's...
I'm not telling you.
So I think that's the sixth sense. And I think we all have it, but I think some of us are maybe more tapped into it or more open to it than others. True. But I think we all have the capability of working on it and developing it.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because we transferred, we've been living in this barn that we're recording this from about 14, 15 months ago. Before that, we were renting an ancient farmhouse from 1652. Mm. So Civil War. And
Your Civil War, not mine.
And it did have, I mean, you know, it had a lot of drafts, so that might have been it, but it did have this effect on the cat. Now, we always have to mention the cat, but the cat would freak out at about 10 to 6 every evening for about 3 minutes.
Yeah, in the living room. We'd be watching TV and suddenly the cat just goes bananas.
Yeah. Uh-huh. She'd start running around chasing some sort of spirit or something like that.
Yeah.
The setting.
And it was regular as clockwork.
Right.
Every day.
Right. Well, we have to pay attention to the animals.
Yeah.
They know. They know things for sure.
Yeah. She knows a lot of things, but she holds some things back. Yeah. I until then I was a bit more agnostic about it, but I suppose I've spent a lot of time myself in places of with great histories in terms of my connection. Initially, when I was a chorister, I was in a very ancient church in Cambridge.
You took me there.
It gave you the willies,
didn't
it? I almost
had a panic attack in that church. Mm. And you did. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, well, you must have sensed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that place as well has witnessed all sorts. Town riots against the university and stuff like that. So there's lots of deep history there. Mm-hmm. And I think if you ever visit, I mean, another occasion when I really felt it, and you know, it's partly the weather, but I went to the Battle of the Somme battlefields, and there's one or two places where they've retained the trench lines and the shell holes and even the barbed wire holding devices. And there you really get a sense. You can actually almost smell the blood. It's very, very evocative and more than spooky. It's actually quite, you know, it reduces you to, I don't know, it humbles you really.
Mm. It's such a heavy, it's almost like a heavy cloak comes over you of that feeling. Yeah. Here, a parallel to that we have over here is the American Civil War.
Gettysburg or somewhere like that.
Yeah. And at one point I lived near the Battle of Antietam. I don't know if you've heard of Antietam, but it was the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. And the stories from this area are just, it's a lot. It's a lot. In fact, just to throw one out real quick, there was a house that was in existence at the time of the battle. Mm-hmm. And the claim was they had a room where they had the soldiers. They were trying to take care of the soldiers. Anyway, afterwards, the room was so bloody, and the floors and the walls and everything were just filled with blood, that to this day, they clean it up and it comes back.
Wow.
Wow.
That's just one story.
Yeah.
There are many others. That. So because the Civil War was so devastating to our country. And so,
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I mean, look, our American listeners will know, you know, this stuff. And actually in the UK, it's not taught. The American Civil War is not. You know, we're busy fighting our own colonial wars at that period. And
absolutely. And it was not that. I mean, the span of things, the time period was not that long that it would feature on world history so much.
No, but but what people don't appreciate, I think, and I'd started reading about it, is just the level of carnage and the, what was it, a quarter of the population killed as a result of the Civil War.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't have a figure in mind, but
You know, an attrition rate far higher than, you know, even the First World War.
Right. And so many physical places that were impacted by it in the terms of a battle or a skirmish or just an incident. Even. So So, you know, especially where I'm located in my area, I can spit and I'll be in another Civil War site. Really, it's that prevalent. It happened all over the place.
Yes.
So when we talk about physical places and events and emotions going on, you know, we're surrounded, really.
Mm. Yeah. I'm intrigued about that. You know, when you're doing research for a book like this.
Yeah.
And I'm drawn towards historic fiction as well, in terms of I'm writing something set in World War II, and I've got a big dream to write something based in Victorian Manchester in about 1860, which was the height of the Industrial Revolution there. Yeah. And Marx and Engels are up the road in the library watching, you know, things unfold and bringing up the Communist Manifesto and all that stuff. But the thing that I find frustrating with it is I've got a story and I want to tell it, but at the same time, I've got to do that research. So that balancing act of knowing when you've got enough to start committing to the story, or did you retrofit anything, or how did it work in terms of the amount of research and then the point where you started to write the fiction side?
So to be perfectly honest, it was that initial plunge down the rabbit hole of those newspaper articles.
Mm-hmm.
Because that provided me so much. As I said, it spooled out over a period of months. And so, I mean, there were articles in Chicago, in LA, coming out about this months later. And so each article would just be filled with new tidbits and new details that hadn't been in the other ones. So that was so much to start with. And then I took it from there and just used the good old Google tool to really find out more. And that became an exercise of where had this story come up in the past in DC historical collections, in journals, in magazines, and it had come up. And then a really quirky thing was there was a cartoonist that was doing cartoons about interesting stories in DC from earlier time periods. There was a cartoon of Blanche Magruder and this story. And the cartoon also got me all fired up, and he had details that were different, but also Blanche's family, the Magruder line, was a historic family that helped settle the area and the city of DC. So that also allowed me to tap into something that's real near and dear to my heart, which is genealogy. So I could look down into the family lines and see where they lived and see all their help. And so there was just, believe it or not, there was enough doing that to provide me the research. And then along with that, as we talked about, was that 1920s, that era of history is always being interesting to me. And then I personally have family connections to DC and that area. That's where my father grew up. That's where his parents were married. That's where their house was located. He went to Georgetown University. So I know the place.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's something with fiction that's interesting, because I've been to different talks about how it can be so helpful to go to a place that you're writing about.
Mm.
And in this case, this is, you know, and I hate to use the trait, you know what you write about what you know, but really I know this.
Yes.
I went to high school in DC too. So I was born in, you know what I mean? So there is something to that, I think, in the way this story took off.
Mm.
And that kind of ties into my second novel that'll be coming out in November. It's a novel I've been working on for over 11 years.
Wow.
And it's been through so many versions, points of view, renditions. But 5 years ago, I had the opportunity to go out to the actual place, which is in California. It's a town in Northern California called Colusa, California. Mm-hmm. And being able to, well, first of all, being able to go out there was a dream come true. But second of all, once I was out there, wow. I mean, that just lit the fire. That sense of place, being there, capturing all those nuances and all those details that I just didn't have it before. You know, you can only do so much with Google Maps, really.
Mm.
And
being there, yeah.
There's something about being there. So back to Spinster's Fortune. I don't know if that's why the novel finally clicked and connected with people.
Yeah. And in terms of how long it took you to complete it, I mean, 11 years is a long one for the second book, but right. How long was Spinster's Fortune?
Spinster's Fortune, I began in 2015. And then the second novel that I'm talking about, and Spinster's Fortune, my rule has always been query 100, at least 100 times and for a year. So I maxed that out with Spinster's Fortune, and I had started on my second novel. I was in the process of doing that. Spinster's Fortune was on the shelf, but there were onesies and twosies that came along every now and then, so I would throw it back out there. And that's the novel that got picked up. It got picked up in December 2020,
right?
Published April 2021. So I started writing it in 2015. So from the point of writing it to getting it published was 5.5 years or so.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And in terms of your day-to-day discipline in terms of writing, what's your rhythm and your work schedule?
So I do better in the morning if it can happen in the morning, but you know, life gets in the way. I really feel strongly that point just after waking up, when you're right between subconscious and conscious and sort of everything's sort of floating around your head. I really feel like that's a great opportunity to capture it. But like I said, you know, life happens. So ideally I am doing a little something every day with writing.
Yeah.
Now the business of writing is different than the creative part of writing, but that business of writing needs to happen too. So sometimes it's tending to that, which I consider I'm doing a bit every day. I am just wrapping up my third novel that I'm getting ready to try to push out there and find a home for. So right now I'm at that exciting point where I'm deciding what I'm going to be working on next for my fourth.
Yeah, that's good.
So excited about that. I haven't quite pinned down what that's going to be. So I'm tending to more of the business stuff right now.
Yeah.
Which has to happen.
Well, it does. And yeah, it's a delicate balancing. I don't know how some authors, particularly in the indie sector, are pumping out 6 books a year with all the attendant publicity and the advertising and stuff they have to do with it as well.
Yeah,
I just don't know how you can do it.
I know. But, I know.
You know, with respect.
Definitely. Definitely. Question. Yeah.
In terms of the reception you've had then, what's it been like? What, you know, have you built a following now as a result of this book?
Yeah, so I was pretty green when I got my my publishing contract for the Spinster's Fortune, and I really had to throw myself in with all 4 feet to try to get up to speed. I didn't even have an author's website at that point, so right. I just hit it hard down the line and tried to get it all going. My publisher has a very warm community of authors that they connected me to, and right away there were tons of ideas, and I just started trying everything. So I have at this point built up a good, fairly good following on all the socials, and I've got my writer's author's website in play, and so I feel I'm in a much better place with that. What really was an incredible stroke of luck with the Spinster's Fortune for me was that, so it was published in April 2021.
Yeah.
In July, I put in for a BookBub featured deal.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. that holy grail, that unicorn, it happened. And it really was just the game changer for my debut novel. Because it ran for 3 days in August 2021. And by the end of those 3 days, there had been 28,000 downloads.
Yes.
And so that just has kept going. That's kept the ball rolling.
Were you offering that at 99 cents or free?
Free. Free for 3 days. Yep. And And the reviews have continued to trickle in on Amazon and Goodreads. I think I'm over 1,500 reviews on Amazon.
Fantastic.
And so, yeah, it just totally, totally put it on the map. And I'm really grateful that it happened. I think there's some Celtic ancestors pulling the strings behind the scenes there. to make that happen. So yeah, that's where that is. And I'm hoping to build on that with the second novel coming out, which is a bit of a change in genre. So I have to confess to being a genre hopper.
Okay.
But but I loved listening to your podcast with Dave McCluskey. Is it McCluskey? Yeah.
Yes.
Because I loved what he said about that. That it's okay to change genres. That's okay to change it up, that it really comes down to voice. And if you have the voice, then you can do it. You know, because there's a lot of hard and fast thoughts about that that's not a good thing to switch it up, especially as early as I am in getting my career going and getting my author career going. But I have such strong feelings about this second novel that it's would call it a coming of age historical fiction. So it doesn't have that mystery element. Now what I'm drawn to writing is mystery. Historical or not. So that's really what I'll be coming back to. But this one that I've been working on for 11 years, I almost consider it an ancestral debt of sorts. And so I'm just so happy that it can finally get out in the world. I really am. It's
and what period are we dealing with in this one?
1850s, Wild West, out in California.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's a real different thing. It's also based on my genealogy pursuits.
Right.
And it's a story that I uncovered about my own family.
Yeah.
And once I uncovered it and I found it, I couldn't not know it.
Yeah.
And I realized I'm the only person that can get this story out there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like I said, it's a bit of an ancestral debt in a way.
Is that Gold Rush period or is that what we're dealing with
here? It is. It's right after the Gold Rush. So what happened for a lot of folks is they didn't get money off of finding gold.
No.
They got money in the aftermath of building up businesses that supported the Gold Rush.
Yes.
And so this particular line of my ancestors did indeed do that. And became
the money was in running the general store and the place where you could get your pick handles.
Yep. And that's exactly
Hollywood films.
Yeah. That's exactly what this ancestor did. And also it's a part, there were boom towns. So a lot of these towns that were founded resulted from all the masses of people coming out there. And then they sort of shuffled the deck because some of the towns they set up immediately became ghost towns because of their placement in the geography didn't work out.
Yes. Yeah. Unsustainable.
Town,
yeah.
Right. But the town that this story is based in is Colusa, California. And the setting was on a river, Sacramento River. And so it continues to be a town to this day. And like I said, I had the opportunity to go see it and it was fascinating. Yeah. To me, it's fascinating. We'll see what everybody else thinks about it.
I like what you said. You said a few minutes ago about the fact that when you actually went to the place, it made a big difference.
Huge difference
to your writing and story. I think you could smell it.
I think I was going to say you can taste it. You can feel that there's if you can convey the atmosphere and the vibe, if that's not a too glib a word.
No, and the events that I was writing about, I could actually stand in the place where they took place.
Yeah.
Because some of the events that took place happened in real life. There was a civil war event way out there.
Really?
That took place. Yeah. Yeah. Gosh. This ancestor was a Southern sympathizer.
Ah.
And when Lincoln was assassinated, he and a bunch of his cohorts celebrated that. At the courthouse.
Oh my God.
I could go to the courthouse and stand on the land where this happened.
Yes.
He and his fellow cohorts were hauled off to Alcatraz Prison in San Francisco.
Really?
Wow. That's amazing.
To the Rock.
It is amazing. And that's just one little snippet of the things.
Well, I'm in for this. This sounds fascinating.
We are a house of history buffs, aren't we?
Well, we are.
Great.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, and then we have that Wolverhampton history connection going on that we talked about.
Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so you know,
how many miles away from
About 16, 17 miles from Wolverhampton.
30 minutes to get there?
Oh, less than. But yeah,
25 minutes to get to Wolverhampton. And I will go and have a look at the street.
And I will go someday because that's another place that I need to go. I need to go stand there and be there because, so much of my family history. In fact, it's too much to get into now, but this Colusa, California story, its roots are from Wolverhampton and where that started. But anyway, so my great-grandfather was a photographer. And he had photography studios all throughout England. Eventually, he got down to Brighton, England. But one of his main places was Wolverhampton. And so I sent you an article. I don't know if you had a chance to open that up. But there's also, it's funny, I just pulled up another, like I said, the internet's populating all the time with updated stuff. Years ago, when I first started doing research, it was down to the card catalog and digging around, there was none of this. So this is just amazing.
Living in the library.
Yeah. And kind of, like I said, I talked to you about it. And then just on a lark, there's more stuff about him in an essay on Wolverhampton that was recently published that I hadn't seen. Anyway, his first shop was on Darlington Street, 41 Darlington Street. His second shop, he migrated over to the US, to Kansas. So his shop up until 1906 was on 49 Queen Street. So he was located, I guess, in the original old city of Wolverhampton.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's where he positioned himself. So he, in this article that I pulled up, it's by a woman named Michelle Nichols. She calls him a celebrated local photographer. And it's really interesting. He pops up as that. And I've never really been able to pin down why. At one point, I think he received an award from the Queen, maybe, but he's a mystery man. He actually changed his name. He has a fake last name.
Ah, I think you need to solve this mystery.
Believe me, I've been trying. The impossible I can do, miracles take me a little longer. So this is one it's a thread that I continue to work on to this day.
Absolutely. Well, come stay. And
I would love to,
we'll have to meet you there.
That would be fantastic.
On this Odyssey. Now, I think it is time, Mary, to challenge you with the greatest challenge in modern podcasting.
Oh no, I'm scared. Okay.
We don't like to build it up too much, but is Rebecca's random question.
Okay, it's related to all of this, funnily enough. We listened to a podcast called
The Rest is History.
The Rest is History. And it's essentially two blokes and they pick a topic. Two top academics who happen to be male. And they pick a topic from history and it could be anything. And they just chat about it. And it's a really good podcast. So I recommend it. But they were talking about, I think the title was Killer Fashions.
Yes.
So I picked that because I thought, oh, Killer Fashions, what's that about? It was about clothing that could kill.
Was inherently dangerous.
Yes, yeah, so things like top hats.
Ballerina's tutu in a candlelit theatres.
Yes. Yeah, so
hundreds and hundreds died.
Top hats that had mercury in them. So, there was poison there.
Yeah.
Green ball gowns with arsenic.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Uh-huh.
So my question to you is sort of related is, what item of clothing from the past do you wish we wore now?
Ooh.
So I'm not talking about something that would kill.
No, not necessarily
that
kill.
Was just what led me to think of the question.
Okay.
Because I like top hats. So.
Okay, so what item do I wish we could wear now? Whalebone corset?
Whalebone corsets, yeah.
That's a good one.
Apart from, now we'd have to find a substitute material for it.
Definitely.
Bumping off a few whales. But
this program, they were talking about it's a type of dress that sort of went down and then out like a bell shape.
Mm.
We were fashionable at once and women would just sort of totter in them.
That you mean, so you would like the bottom part of that, the hoop part of it?
Yeah.
Because didn't they use a hoop contraption?
Oh, yes, they did.
To keep that up on a frame. So it was like a frame, walking around on a frame.
Absolutely. No. They did. It was a certain type of new steel that allowed them to build those very, very large skirts that sort of, if you think of King and I and that sort of thing.
They must have been heavy.
Oh, they were. They were.
So the weight, but also to carry apparently that around, extremely
dangerous, because if you the spark from a fire, you know, you weren't aware that your the back of you was near it. People were consumed with flames by these things. So I mean, there was the Grand Duchess of what was it? The Archduchess of Austria was consumed by fire.
Yes,
because of her dress.
Because of her dress. Yeah.
Okay, wait a minute. I just thought of something better. Can I can I change it up real quick?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go on.
So the time period, which may have been Marie Antoinette's time period, where they had the huge hairdos with bird cages in the middle.
Oh yeah.
What I'm speaking of, that would be cool. That would be cool to recreate that.
Not in
I probably don't have enough hair to tease up to do that.
Yeah, you need lots of hair.
Well, I'm an ancient historian, so I'd go for a toga, a decent imperial toga, you know, with a bit of purple.
There's nothing to stop you going into our local town, Newport, in a toga.
There you go. And quite comfortable. Of all the things we're talking, that would be the most comfortable.
Absolutely.
And flowing, airflow, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I have worn a kilt to an occasion, and it was a Cornish tartan kilt, and I hadn't appreciated just how hot the damn thing was going to be and how heavy. And you think no wonder the rumors are that no one wears anything underneath, because
you can't, right?
It's heavy
too much,
heavy and hot. It really was. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you so much for joining us. Got to ask you, in terms of the writing career going forward, so you know, you've got plans for, you're thinking about a fourth book. Is this going to be the rest of your life now? Are you absolutely passionate about this?
So to this point, I've always been writing. So even if I had not been able to become an author and officially get the books out there, I would still be writing. It's I view it as my way of processing the world. It's my bit of creativity that is available to me, that allows me to process and to get out there what I need to get out there. So I would be writing with or without the books out there. But that said, I'm extremely grateful that I am able to get the books out there.
Yeah.
You know, it means the world to me.
And as a child tries to steal a Diet Coke, we return from Mary Kendall's interview. And
he was quite stealth then, though. I didn't hear him.
Well, he's of your three children, he's the only one you never hear, because he can move.
Oh, like we certainly hear the other two.
Like a ninja. The other two are like elephants.
Oh, he creeps off to put it in the freezer.
Yeah, the fact that he's still doing that, having been spotted, is a bit daft. But I'll let him off. He's just finished his GCSEs. Congratulations, Josh, for getting through it. And Luke finishes next week.
On Monday, actually.
On Monday, wow. Okay, well, we've got some kids on loose ends, so we can get those weeds sorted, so we can get the mowing done. All those sort of things that young people should be forced to do. And this place tidied up.
Yes.
That does need it.
It does need it desperately.
It does. It's a real state at the minute. Anyway, that's largely my fault, as usual. So
That's what you can do on the week when I'm on holiday.
Yeah.
Then.
Now, you've been busy this week doing something which a lot of other publishers have done, and we've just woken up to, and this was suggested by Linda Huber.
I was panicking and thinking, what have I done?
Well, it's called copy editing. No, it's not that. It's called printing. No, it's not that. It's changing or adding categories on Amazon.
Yes. So it's like you say, Linda Huber, we have to thank. We knew about this vaguely, didn't we?
We did, but I mean, you hear it mentioned, but actually the practicals of doing it. So what happens when you put a book on KDP? You get three categories that you can nominate.
Actually, only two.
Only two. Mm. Sorry, yes, you're right. Two categories when you put a book onto the Amazon system or Kindle Direct Publishing, KDP. And then there's a system where if you can find the categories, like the A-team, if you can find them, you can ask for Amazon to list your books against these smaller niche categories.
Yeah, and often actually more accurate. So it's a bit more complicated. So when you put a book on the KDP dashboard, you have a choice of two categories. Now, you can select these from a drop-down list, and this drop-down list is very broad. So you can't put erotica, mountain goats, or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's usually police procedurals or traditional or cozy, you know. So they're very broad, and you can't do anything until the book's published. Once the book is published, you can email KDP and give them a list of categories you'd like a particular ISBN, particular book to be set in.
Mm-hmm.
And so this week I had a spare couple of hours and I thought, I'm going to send KDP a really big email. And I found some really good categories for many of our books, but most of them, at least one new category. And we can see results already, can't we?
We can. We can. So let's have a look.
And they're not stupid categories, I'd like to add. They are relevant to the
not.
Book.
They're not stupid categories, really.
No mountain goats.
No. Okay, so I'm just looking at the Genesis Inquiry by Ollie Jarvis, which we published back in October. And it is number one.
Yay!
In sacred texts.
Well done, Ollie.
It's number five in criminal law. But we have a number one bestseller as a result, which is fantastic.
And Harry Fish, currently two of his books are number two in different categories. So
yeah, yeah. So it works. I mean, a lot of the bigger publishers, you know, the Joffeys of the world, certainly I would say Bold would do it a lot.
It's funny, I was looking at Boldwood.
And Bloodhound.
I did. In my research, I did a lot of research on the categories that Boldwood choose for their books and Bloodhound.
Yeah, they're all at it. And so are we now. It gets you a number one bestseller tag, which
we hope will have an impact on sales.
Yeah, and it's going to mean, yeah, it's going to titillate the algorithm for sure.
Yeah, that's the aim.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, we're continuing to invest. The other thing, piece of news I wanted to pass on this week was that Malcolm Hollingdrake's been organising Harrogate Noir, which is being held in September in Harrogate, and has invited, alongside himself, some other authors, including Ollie Jarvis, aforementioned author of the Genesis Inquiry. We're sponsoring the event, which is in conjunction with Harrogate Libraries.
Does that mean we're going to sell ice creams outside the front door?
Possibly. But the Hoback cat logo is all over the publicity now. So look out for more details of that event as we go. But, you know, happy to support Malcolm and the event. It sounds fab.
And thank you, Ollie, for coming along too.
Yeah, that'll be good. He's a great talker. So what else have we got to cover this week? Anything else?
We're not publishing any books in June, are we?
No, that's really weird, actually, how that's worked out.
Well, it's because we had three in May and we've got three in July. So, okay. You know, it didn't quite work out. But June has been crime reading month.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been pushing all of our books, you know, in a general sense. You know, come on, everybody, read a crime book if you haven't read one before.
Yeah.
And we're getting to the end now. So I hope people have enjoyed reading our books if they've taken up my pleas on Twitter.
Absolutely. Now, next week, it's our special, isn't it not? Or is it going to be my London Travails
well,
special?
We're hoping, yes. We're hoping that you manage to find some people to talk to you in London.
Yes, back there in London. I'll do my best.
Yeah.
And then the following week, we've got a special.
We've got the two journalists.
We have, yeah. We met two fantastic leading journalists at Crime Fest, and we wanted to talk about, it was a pet subject of mine, how badly represented journalism is in fiction. A bit like, I'm sure all cops think that, you know, procedurals are nonsense compared to the reality. So that's what we discussed. We'll get into that in a couple of shows' time. So that'll be show number 79. But 78 will be from the SBS live show and from the Daggers and obviously from Anglesey, where you will be. And I shall be.
We might have to do it before I go, I think.
Do you think?
For that one, yeah.
No. We can link up.
We could do it live from Tears for Fears.
We're going to see Tears for Fears
next
week.
I know, we're going to see Tears for Fears.
I'm going to see Crowded House as well. I've got a busy week with all sorts of, you know.
But have you found someone to go with, though?
No, not yet, no.
We've got to find someone to go with.
I know. I'll put it out there. Anyone from wanting to go and see Crowded House with me, by all means, drop us a line. Anyway, that's been the Hobcast, show number 77. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, of course, to go to our website, www.hobeck.net. Details of our audiobooks. Our paperbacks are available to sell there too, to buy rather. And all the details of our authors and our plans and our latest news. And perhaps we might even get around to writing a blog this week.
I've written one. I wrote one yesterday.
Yeah, you did. We have written a new blog. Go and see it at our website. But from me, Adrian Hobart.
And me, Rebecca Collins, the one on the ball.
Thank you. And the sleeping cat, Aki the cat. We'd like to thank you for joining us. And we wish you a wonderful and, well, you know, the rest of the school.
Shall I say it?
Go on then.
Creative week.
Yeah. Creative week.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to The Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.